Hey, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today. I appreciate it. Could you just start by telling us your name, where you work, and what it is that you study?
Sure. My name's Don Kurtz, and I'm a professor of social work at Kansas State University and also a criminologist. All my research has been in that area, and I'm the department head of sociology, anthropology, and social work at Kansas State.
And are you there right now or in Kansas, or did
I
you?
am, yeah. I'm locked into my virtual office in the basement, like a lot of people now. We moved off campus in March, about mid-March. We sort of had to transition. Obviously, our spring break was when things started getting pretty real here in Kansas, and then we quickly made the move to virtual semester. And we did that the week after spring break. We gave everybody a sort of gap week to figure things out, so there was supposed to be no assignments and other things like that. And then we developed plans for office. Basically, our campus building's pretty much locked. There's some people have access. We're lucky in that our disciplines, while they do have labs, they don't have sort of like the biological science labs where there's things you have to worry about as much. So we were able to transition and shut those down pretty well. We're in the College of Arts and Sciences here, where there's biology, chemistry, physics. So those areas were a little more difficult.
How are you finding it? Are you still managing to stay productive, or are you super
Yeah,
stressed?
I
How do you
would say,
manage?
research production falls a little bit. I did get an article that was toward the end finished and out with a journal, but especially since I was interim department head and just accepted the position as permanent here a week ago. But I had a lot of stuff with transitioning and managing that kind of kills research. My teaching, I was all right. I was teaching a 200 level social work class on basic skills of working with people. And I'm a little bit lucky in that I've taught online before. So the transition wasn't as extreme for me as I know it was for other people.
Well, talking about transitions, taking over a department in the midst of this must not be, it must be have some unique challenges.
Yeah, I was interim for a year, so I guess, in that sense that I was able to transition some into it. But there's higher ed is in for, I think, a bumpy ride. I do think it's going to recover, and there'll be some transitions and maybe look a little different. But it is going to be an interesting time for sure.
Yeah, well, luckily I'll be hitting the job market just as all of this trouble really comes and settles
So
in.
it's interesting. We just had a brown bag with our graduate students, and it was about the job market. Now, we planned this in January, so it was going to be more of a general idea, planning when you're going to graduate, when you go out on the market, just what the process is. And it's a whole year out for most of those jobs. So but obviously a lot of the questions now were, well, what's the market look like next year? And you have to be honest to say not particularly strong, but we'll see. It just depends on if there's problems with sort of a second wave of COVID and a continued wave. If we recover fairly quickly, I could actually see some growth areas for the sort of disciplines we teach.
Right.
So I know social work, sociology, criminologists, when there's these sort of major crises and they see social meaning in some of those jobs, I do think there could be people that come back. And if the market's a little slow, some will come back because they can't get a job that they
Right.
can have, so they will choose college.
I think I read that following the 2008 nine crash, that there was a surge immediately following. I wasn't in academia at the time, but I think something like that did happen. Do you know, or I'm not
Yeah,
sure.
for K-State, our largest probably year enrollment was maybe 2011 or 2012. So it was a buildup. Now it's a little complicated because when there's economic crashes too, the share of state funding also starts to reduce. States are managing budgets. So we're becoming, like most schools, more reliant on tuition dollars than funding dollars. And so we're really tied to the number of students and number of credit hours and things like that.
Yeah, I've really noticed that because I was in school when I was younger and then came back at an older age, and I could really see how the market had penetrated academia and these sort of market-based, these neoliberal sort of,
yeah,
you know, had really gotten into academia.
And even I would say the structures have gone more CEO models. You know, I think they're heavier hierarchies now in terms of you know, compensation for presidents and additional executive staff and things along those lines.
So. Yeah, I went to ASU, Arizona State, and Michael Crow, who's like, I think is the perfect exemplar of that, like the CEO, president of a university, you know, business model, private partnerships, how to fund academia. It's going to be interesting to see how that shapes up after this crisis. So where are you from? Are you from Kansas or?
I'm actually from Kansas City area. So I grew up in Kansas City, Kansas. And then I went to a Catholic high school in Kansas City named Bishop Ward. And then I actually, when I was younger, wanted to be a police officer. So right out of high school, I joined the Kansas National Guard as a military police officer. And my idea was, well, I'll do this and maybe start community college when I come back. And then when I'm 21 and you're eligible to be a police officer, I could go off and do that. And my interest was always sort of in crime and justice areas. And, you know, it was early 90s kid too, where all the, I mean, our whole society became pretty infatuated with crime areas, partly because that was the heart of the spike in crime. And then I came back and started going to community college, and then I transferred and started looking into social work as a major, and then kind of fell in love with that. And I knew that my interests were still in areas of crime and justice, but maybe not as a role of a police officer. So when I got out, I did a master's degree in clinical social work, and then I got out and worked in juvenile probation for several years, and then went back for a doctorate.
Okay. And so for this particular project, this might not be a familiar sort of methodology for a lot of folks. Can you tell us a little bit about, so how you collected your data for this project, how you code process that data, and then how you analyze it? So just how you collect and work with these data.
So, and it's interesting, I believe you read one of the narrative papers, which were sort of the long arc of my interest there. So my PhD interest was in stress in policing. In particular, I wanted to look at sort of gendered element of police organizations. And my concern was that the masculinization of the profession would make it difficult for officers to manage the trauma of the job in maybe the more pro-social ways. You know, going to see a therapist if it was needed, you know, employee assistance programs. I had plenty of officers tell me that's kind of you don't want to get known as somebody who went and did that. And so that was kind of where I started, was my interest. And I did a mixed methods dissertation. I used a data set and ran some analysis. I had to use some proxy variables for a gendered element in a police organization. So whether the department accepted women or whether there were sort of offensive gender jokes. And what I found was the departments that had reported higher levels of that had higher stress responses and burnout responses by the officers. So that was, you know, a proxy analysis. But then I conducted interviews with just under 30 officers in departments of various sizes. And these were more detailed. And I initially went in with questions about stress and whether you could talk about it and mental health. But I had one particular question that then sparked the arc of this project that's kind of continued. And that was how do officers interact with each other? And what kept coming up was this idea of stories. Like, oh, we tell these stories, we tell war stories. And so that became a little part of my dissertation. But what happened was I then became more interested in it, and I started looking over and over for more elements of storytelling literature that was out there, and I came across Fletcher's work. And then it kind of set on that. I wrote a paper called Reinventing the Matron that looked at how sort of images and depictions of women sort of fit that old classic idea of a matron. You're here with the juvenile delinquents, the victims of sex offenses and things like that a little bit that persisted. But then narrative criminology came along and I started reading more into that area and that fit. So I went back and reanalyzed all my original areas where they talked about stories. And with that and greater police storytelling literature I got exposed to, I realized that there were that this was a big heart of what they were talking about. And then I sort of used a qualitative analysis technique. Now, I will tell you, I'm an old school coder, which means I have Word documents. I go read them. I start making notes and I use color coding.
So this just to back up a little. So this didn't start as a qualitative project. This started with you sort of finding a way to operationalize managing stress and operationalizing levels of masculinity within departments. And you found that departments that were engaging these playing out these masculine roles, there was an association with higher levels of difficulty maintaining.
Well, and what I would say was officers who reported higher levels of stress. The original set I used was actually Baltimore Police. It's an open ISPCR data set.
Okay.
And so if you go back, you can see I sort of published in two arcs, quantitative data about police stress and its impact on women. But then I also was interested in more qualitative detail because there's not, I didn't have the money, especially early in my career, to go out and do a gigantic data set collection. So, but I did have the ability to access officers and interview them.
Okay.
And then from that, I conducted I think it was 28 or 29 total interviews. And then I audio taped them all and then had them all transcribed. Okay. And that was the offshoot of some of my qualitative work. It was included in the dissertation and then a couple of early publications out of it. And then I switched to focus to narrative, which now continues. I'm actually have it on an NSF grant. We're looking at cybersecurity units, but my interest in that is some of the narrative elements. So I have that included in the interviews we're doing now as well.
So this move, the shift from the, so you started with a little bit of the qualitative stuff, but it was a shift to the narrative. To analyzing narratives came as the methodology developed. So as you were exposed to new ways of analyzing data and collecting, processing data, that's when you sort of, you shifted
yep.
to using these. And so you collect, you have to do the interviews, you code the interviews, you find these themes and then write about these themes. And that's sort of the process.
Right. Yep. And so I go back and reread the themes. I color coded them again when I went back and looked at narrative elements. So this time I was looking, and what one of the limitations of what is actually the data I collected personally, because I had a lot of officers talk about stories and provide a few examples, but they didn't provide me very detailed stories. And so any future data as I collect, in fact, I have a chapter on looking at the narratives for law enforcement in the new handbook of narrative criminology that's coming out. And it identifies what I think should be areas people look for when they go and interview police officers if they're interested in narrative elements. And then I also had another data set a colleague of mine, Travis Linneman, had collected with his PhD a dissertation that interviewed officers in other areas. And I had some narrative elements of analysis I could pull from those. So I have another paper in critical criminology that incorporated both data sets where I use narrative themes in it.
Okay. And to talk a little bit about, so we were talking about narratives. Can you just talk a little bit about what you mean by narratives in the context of research and how narratives and stories can help us better understand culture? And could you just talk sure. a little bit about that?
So Presser and Sandberg's original argument was that narratives basically take on a couple of forms. One is sort of an official record, and having been a probation officer and previously a military police officer, that makes sense. You write a narrative report with almost anything you've done. And so their idea that these exist, a court report, all these are examples of official narratives. And you could think this expands to a lot of mental health, you know, therapist notes, things like that. So it's a, this fits with what we often think of. It's an official written report. The other part is a narrative that sort of becomes what we tell about an event. So you and I could experience the same event and develop different narratives, right? So, and you know, this is from family interactions and other things that we have all kinds of events, life, things that happen to us. And over time, we can develop a narrative related to that event. And actually, that narrative can change even though the underlying events don't change.
Right.
The first one's more factual based, although we know that those kind of narratives can be wrong too, a la people are wrongfully convicted in court, et cetera. And also the same narrative, sort of official narrative, could be different from different vantage points, right?
Right.
The second one's more psychological and cognitive. So it's how you internalize an event and then what your process is through. So I teach social work and I bring this up and I do it in sort of a way that even 21, 22-year-old college students can get. And I will say, think of your first significant other relationship, boyfriend, girlfriend, et cetera, and how at that time it was really important. And maybe if you broke up with them in high school, how it was this big life-altering event. And so that was an actual experience. You felt it. Those feelings don't go away. But even a few years later, we develop a narrative around that. Like, oh, that was sort of a childish relationship, or that made me who I am today. Those sort of things. And even, you know, college students who don't have as much world experience can wrap their heads around that. And so That's the second part of a narrative. It's sort of the development we have about it. And those are interesting because they change
right.
over time. Some are more static, some are more malleable. Some are changed by alternate events that happen later. And then the third one is that I'm also kind of interested in is that narratives that then shape your choices. So if you think of somebody who takes on the identity of, say, a juvenile delinquent, something like that, that identity becomes internalized and then it affects how they interpret events and then the choices they make. And so those are sort of the big frameworks that exist out there for narrative. And then you can actually see how these can play a role in research in a number of ways. If somebody wanted to go back and go through court records, they could go through official narratives, they could do interviews with people, understand it, but then also the more hard analysis or more difficult analysis is then how does this narrative then shape behavior or choices? And then these have been explored a lot of ways, a lot of individual research, but then there's also bigger things like, you know, and it's become in popular culture as well, too. You can see newspapers will even use the term narratives or control narrative. Political identity is also about trying to control a narrative. So those are the main three areas.
So the first one is these official narratives. And I totally attest to that. Like when I was a police officer, there are a lot of pressures on an individual and when they're constructing these narratives. So if you're sitting down to write your police report, you have to make it fit the legal framework that you operate under. You have the policy framework. You have the cultural signals that you're sending to the people that are going to read it. And all of these things help shape what, and you may not be being dishonest. Right. You may be, but if you're being honest, it's going to vary depending on all of those. And also there's also a personal imprint on those official documents. And then so that's the first one. And the second one are the narratives that you're saying they like can change over time because it's where and when you are in time and space and who you are as an individual at that moment is going to influence the meaning you ascribe to an event that took place.
Right. So they're interpretive of the situation, but then also interpretive of who you are and who you are in social context.
Right. And your audience as well.
Right. Well, of course.
Yeah, because we're telling these stories, they're a performance. When we tell a story, even if we're not aware of it, we're trying to tell the person something about us or about a lesson, or there's some meaning, or else why tell the story, right? And then the last one you talk about is this, where there's like a sort of a label being ascribed to a person that to draw on the, like the site. Is that where you're, is it like a label?
Yeah, it can kind of become an identity, but for the narrative analysis, it's then how does this identity, I guess, for lack of a better term, then shape your behavioral choices going forward.
Okay. And this is one of the things I love about this is that is it's such an ancient way of that human beings relay information. I grew up until I was 9 or 10 years old in a small fishing village on an island in Canada, Nova Scotia on the East Coast, just a few hundred people. And there was a little gas station in the middle of town with some benches, and the old men from the community, the old fishermen, would sit on the benches and they would tell these stories to one another. And it's recreation, but it's also a body of knowledge that's being generated and transmitted to people that are going to maybe have similar experiences.
Right. And related to that, and this isn't necessarily with policing, but I've gotten interested in family narratives and then how they shape intergenerational ones. So if you think about the stories you even hear about yourself before you're born, then shape kind of who you become. And so I was just having a discussion on a juvenile delinquency grant. It was an online seminar or whatever. And one of the participants said that her son sort of got labeled this way and it kind of carried with him. And she said, it's partially true, but he had trouble latching on her breast when he was born. And on the nurse's report, they put, he's a stubborn baby. And so those stories got told, and she's like, he just sort of took on this stubborn persona that like stuck through his life. And she's like, he is stubborn, but how much of that is even that this story got told to him when he's 3 or 4 and you start to develop an identity that relates to that. And then your behaviors are then shaped a little on that identity.
Right. Or we have people in the community, they say things about us and we, you know, and they maybe see something positive about us that's related to a certain characteristic. And then we're drawn to want to continue. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things I love about qualitative methods is because it really shows, it shines a light on the fact that human beings are infinitely complicated.
Right.
And so it's when you break down numbers, you measure, there's value, but it really just, it leaves so much unsaid about what's happening.
Yeah, I like to, I do a lot of mixed method. I think one can start to tell you a story or at least what's a trend is, but then you really have to dive in.
Absolutely.
So when I try to explain the difference to students, I give an example that, you know, to understand. If I give a quiz, what I do is initially just quantitative. Go pull up the quiz statistics and you can look and see, oh, is there a certain percentage that got one question wrong? And then from that, sometimes I even give you stats like the top, you know, 20% scores did better or worse than the bottom. And then from there, that if it's a real, like, you know, a big portion of the class got it wrong, that tells me something's going on. Then you go up and read the question. You can also find that's where it becomes qualitative. Is the wording off, something misplaced or something like that. So I always think of those as how quantitative and qualitative can fit together. You can see a trend quantitatively, but that doesn't tell you really what's going on with the trend. The same way qualitative does.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the role of narrative, the role of stories across all human cultures, it's fair to say it's an important thing. Police culture, is there something distinct? Because I've had a bunch of different kinds of jobs and interacted with people from a wide variety of lifestyles, but there's something about police culture in my mind that stories, they're just an integral part of the culture. Do you feel the same?
And I think there's a lot of literature that pointed that out. And I would say maybe even in criminal justice, I know that as a probation officer, oftentimes when we were grabbing beers after work, we were sort of telling the stories. But there's some really important things about police culture that I think are relevant, where that stories and narrative are really important. One, I think it's a bonding element as well. It's how officers connect to each other in some ways. And, you know, obviously in some ways, police organizations and as a culture, you know, and I know there's conflict about whether to call it a culture or not, but they do, they can feel socially isolated in a lot of ways. And so their interactions are often with each other. And then some of that relates to work. So I had lots of officers say, well, all of our interactions and talk is almost always about work. And then it goes to stories. Another thing that I think is unique for policing is it's one of the few professions that you maybe come to the job with all kinds of stories from our popular culture. We all, you know, dime store books, the movies, all the TV shows, et cetera. And then those don't necessarily reflect what's the day-to-day part of the job. So the stories allow the collection of the more dramatic events that will ignore that maybe 4 days, not much happened, but boy, we had this foot chase one day, and that becomes the story that collapses time and space in some ways. And then I think this is where the pre-narrative fits a little bit. So you have an idea of what you think the job will be, so then you can fit your stories a little bit to fit with the popular culture view. So I think a big part of its interaction, I think a big part of it is in our broader culture. And then another area that I think is useful is that some of what you do in policing is not like you can just pull out a policy and procedure manual and break it down. So those become frameworks, but how officers teach each other is through stories. Like, oh, back the first time when I was a rookie, I did this, and here's how you learn, and here's how you manage that. And so I think there's that element. And then thirdly, a few jobs, it really becomes an identity element, and the stories help manage that identity, both what you tell and don't tell people, right? And the stories officers tell each other are not the same as they share with the general public in most cases.
No.
Yeah. And then I also still remain interested in how storytelling becomes a form of de-stressing.
Right. And the last thing you touched on is sort of, I found, and again, this is my experience, but that there was the gaining of the story. So going out onto the street and engaging in police work, one of the things that I was searching for was an experience that would lend itself to the construction of a great story.
Right.
Because in the social gatherings, and we'll talk a little bit about the different types of social gatherings, but as I was engaging in the social gatherings, almost my whole life was exclusively with police officers, because that bubble that you find yourself in, that the ability to earn prestige and the respect and friendship was really tightly tied to the ability to come to and sit down and tell a fun police story. Right. And it really did drive, I think, and again, this is me telling this story years after, so who knows why I'm constructing it this way.
Now you constructed the identity around it.
Right, but in this particular time and space, I'm placing importance on that. And I think there's some truth to it. Do you feel as though there's a prestige element in that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I think for one of the gender elements, this is where one of the critical points, because... it's hard. A lot of officers acknowledge that these stories are kind of bullshit. Like they start out as there's a real event there, but then it becomes a more dramatic thing over time, right? Or something that everybody was sort of scared or worried about becomes a humorous event. Not always quite like some of it was dark humor, not quite black humor where you're completely making fun of, you know, a victim or something like that, or an offender, but there's could be elements of that. But I do think that's an interesting element, because it removes the idea that there was fear. You could be more heroic in the retelling of the story. And I did find that, you know, sometimes women felt a little excluded from that part, because if it's like I walked into it and there was like four people here and I had to fight with four of them or something like that, that they might get more challenged on the baloney part of a story, whereas the men tended not to get. So I had one in my interview say, you got to be really careful about that as a woman, jumping in and telling a sort of war story like you're the hero of it, because people might challenge you.
Okay, so the war story is a feeling of being challenged.
Right.
You
Not
met
excluded all from stories, but maybe, and there's some in the literature where maybe they have to be more consumers of the story or be a part of the story, but not maybe the lead character of it.
So they weren't able to enter that space and then portray themselves as the protagonist in the
Right.
story
In the same way.
where they're carrying out this sort of heroic role. Did you this is something, because I encountered stories where women were, in my policing experiences, where women were the protagonist and they were carrying out these very ma like performing masculinity in a way that you would want, like in the culture we want our male hero warrior officer to perform masculinity. And I think and when I heard those stories and told those stories and continue to tell those stories, I think there was an element of maybe laying out what it would take for a woman to live up to it. And they're just as unrealistic as the stories we tell about our male colleagues. Did you hear stories
So
where
I did have one. It was a community officer, and she talked about it. And she was actually African American, and this one always stuck out to me. And she's like, "Man, I had like there was sort of a double distrust in me when I started, like in her estimation." And one of the things she said, if the other officers didn't truly trust me until I accidentally broke a dude's arm in a struggle. And she says what happened really was he was up on this wall that was like 6 feet on the ground, above the ground. And she went up to approach him and he kind of went to try to run. And she's like, he literally just fell down the wall and broke his own arm. And she's like, I was actually panicked that I was going to get blamed for this. But for whatever reason, she's like, that story took off that, I was able to break this guy's arm for being resistive and combative. And then after that, she said she felt more accepted by the group. And so that's one example that I think fits with yours. And the story became that she, and this is a long time ago. So this is even my story of a story. So,
Right,
but
which
I
they
think she said
are.
that people were saying that she was like, oh, she must be really skilled in combat, like, MMA arm breaking techniques or something like this. And so it became a funny point for her that that's when they started to trust her in a more direct way.
Then
So.
did you just,
A little bit with what you're saying.
and I don't know if you, I found this particular thing interesting. Do you think that, did she mention if this was them not understanding what had happened or them knowing what had happened, but constructing this story to frame her in this particular way? Do you know?
And this was back when I conducted those interviews and
Oh,
wasn't
okay.
interested in narrative, so I can't. It would be really strong speculation on my part because I didn't ask follow-up questions. If I had that interview now, that part would take like 30 minutes just going through.
Right.
But I got the sense that she, that sort of, they projected that, but she also felt like, oh, it created a space for her to be accepted, and she wasn't going to refute it in a lot of ways like that.
Right, and it's because it's there's something that's, even if it's not necessarily the whole truth, it's earning her prestige and position within the department. So these stories, we need to take them with a grain of salt, obviously. But does it matter? Does it matter if the story isn't true? Can it still tell us
Well,
something?
the narrative people will say specifically it doesn't matter if a story is true, if it becomes an important part of identity, becomes a way people shape things. What I always think would be the interesting part is a story that's told sort of as a war story, but then how it's testified to in court and the differences, because I think officers would know, like, oh, I'm not going to, this is a baloney story when we're all sitting around, but that's not how I would testify to it in court. So that tells you that they, and the officers I interviewed, many of them said, well, we know these are kind of fake stories. One of them, I think, direct quote was something along the lines of, we kind of tell what we did, but then we add stuff. And so I don't think the truth matters in the same way. There's a couple of authors that'll argue that these become folklore or metaphors or other things that explain what the culture is, how you're supposed to be, helps you shape behavior more than it's supposed to be a factual account.
Right. And I found, like, having interviewed, you know, thousands of people in policing, like people who are suspected of a crime, is having them tell a story, starting with a narrative of that particular day, the things that they tell you that are incorrect can sometimes shed more light than the things that they tell you that are true. It tells you about intention, what type of drama they're trying to play out for you, how they're trying to influence you. So that totally makes sense.
Right. And even in every story, depending, you mentioned audience earlier, because we play them differently too, but the details we include and exclude are often shaped by our audience and what we want to convey at any given time. So sometimes we might include more details, and other times we might hold out something.
Right, because the story is the ultimate performance. We have some information about ourselves or some lesson that we want to transmit, and we recognize who what the prejudices and previous experiences of our audience are, and we're gonna shape that. The story I tell my wife is different than I tell my son or my daughter, or you know, their age, you know, or a friend or a colleague, my policing friends, my friends who are in academia, that they're going to be completely different stories.
And these also occur in families. So I think a few years back was telling a story, or my brother was telling a story, and one of us couldn't figure out which one this really happened to from when we were kids. And I swore I was the one that this happened to, and my younger brother swears, no, it was him. And so just think about how that story changes over time and can affect us that way.
Absolutely. My wife and I, it's the same thing. She's constantly stealing my jokes and then claims that she came up with them. And then she claims it's the other way around. Just kidding. Just to back up a little bit about gender, you talk about gender. Can you talk a little bit about, so people who are not familiar with the, you know, the masculinity or the feminist literature, can you talk about doing gender, what that means?
So the idea of doing gender in most simplistic terms is it's sort of a performance, which then in a lot of ways fits with this narrative analysis as well. And so the idea that certain behavioral scripts or mannerisms or other things are then become related to gender, and that's separated from biological sex, and that doing gender often is these performances that we can develop over time. And then they can vary from setting to setting. So it can be done in a lot of ways. And so in criminology, it's been looked at a couple ways, some things like violence as a masculine resource for doing gender. So if you look at most violent crime, it's still pretty much tied to men. And also it could be a limiting element. So, performances by women may not be accepted in the same way. And so that's kind of a precept. And then the idea of a sort of masculinized organization is one where the culture is more geared toward, I would say, those masculine type scripts. And so you brought up a good example that, sometimes they'll talk about women police officers as like, well, it takes a special type of woman to make it through this job. So the idea that they can adapt to that sort of masculine environment is what's implied by that in most cases. And so I think that fits well within a framework of looking at policing. And then, by the way, it still remains one of the most gendered jobs in terms of the distribution of men and women. So I haven't looked at the most recent data, but it's been around 14% women. I know it's been growing, but it's also been hard to recruit women in particular. And part of that relates back to the idea that policing is about making arrests and physical confrontations, which ignores all the other things a really good cop does, like talks to people, interacts with individual, helps people when they're in need, does service calls, has to write well, has to be able to communicate well. So it collapses the entire job down to who can win a fist fight at times. And where this becomes an interesting aspect for women is because of on average size differences, it sort of creates this idea that women aren't good for the job, or they're going to be in trouble if there's a physical altercation. Mm-hmm. Ignores the fact that they're officers of all kinds of range of physical abilities, right? A 60-year-old who's 35 pounds overweight is not going to do particularly well in a fist fight with a 21-year-old who's, you know, tweaking on meth or something like that. So, but I, you know, what I've found and some of the literature pointed out that women get pointed to this as a problem more and more.
Yeah, I know when I was at the academy, I got to teach at the police academy, and we had a female recruit who had a difficulty with some physical fitness stuff and the combatives stuff. She had some difficulty. She was well-educated. Her report writing was top off the charts. Her ability to carry out a conversation, interview people, social skills, social intelligence, all of the skills that were going to make her a fantastic investigator, a fantastic at dealing with the public, of calming people down, all of those skills were completely ignored. And all of the focus amongst the cadre, the people who were in charge of training her, were on, well, she's going to get her ass kicked. She's right. going to get somebody hurt. Violence is a component of policing. But like you said, the vast majority of the time, you're not tussling around in the dirt. You're interviewing people, you're writing reports.
Right. And in some of the other skills you describe could also lead to avoiding some of the physical.
Absolutely.
Or at least controlling them verbally until somebody else could come help. So Fletcher, and she cited in the article if you want to look her up, but she had looked at storytelling, and she was specifically looking at women, and she had this concept of the core story. And this was the idea that it was often dictated toward women officers, but it was a story that what are you going to do the day you're in an alley and you don't have your gun and you don't have your radio and this 250-pound monster or gorilla or whatever the term they use for a really big guy is there and it's just you and him. And how are you going to manage that? And it was particularly used against women. Now, the reality of that is any officer by themselves without all their equipment, without their ability fighting a 250-pound man is not going to be in a good position. And the other part is, nope, what are you leaving all your other equipment in the car and just strolling around on duty? So there's a real absurdity about the story. But what I found interesting, when I came across her literature, and she did that in the middle 90s, and she said this came up in some 200 interviews. And then of my interviews a decade later, it came up multiple times, and it's a story that's out there.
Yeah, jump in a patrol car today. I mean, it's been a handful of years for me, but I call them the 101 stories. So we, in our department, the 101 was the radio call, like the code for a female.
Okay.
So the story would be, we were doing X, Y, and Z, and 101 officer shows up and X happens.
Oh, okay, got you.
It would always be some type of tactical snafu that left people in a dangerous situation. And those stories, like, were told throughout the day. It was a very, very common story. So I think it's probably the same story. I just gave it a different name.
Right, and related to that, too, you know, a couple of the women officers I interviewed said that a mistake by a woman officer was always held up as like, this is why women can't do it. And a mistake by a male officer was not held up in the same way. It was just like, oh, this person made a mistake. And so one of the stories I did include in the paper you read was about a woman officer who went into a jail, and you know, most jails have you turn your gun in, but their department didn't want their gun in physical possession of somebody else. So they made it a policy. You put your gun, your sidearm, in the back of your trunk of your car. She goes in, goes about her day of work, comes out, and shows up somewhere and is not wearing her sidearm. And this became a big story that everybody told about her. And she, you know, discussed with like multiple people have done this, but this became about women officers. So he's like, one of the police detectives or big shot detectives or somebody in a higher admin did this and was on TV later walking around without their gun, and nobody ever talks about it, but I did it, and it became an idea like, well, got to be careful about women officers. They'll do things like this.
Right. So the experience was that the story, the things that were happening for for everybody, could happen to anybody. Like, to me, that's something we had to do with the jail, was take your weapon out, put it in the trunk. And multiple times I found myself driving down the road to a call and got to the habit of checking to make sure I put my weapon back in my holster, because it's a very, you get in your car and you leave and it's an easy thing to forget.
Right, exactly.
But for the women, they were finding that those same stories took on new meaning because they had, there was a gendered element, because they were a female. If that story then became part of a collection of stories designed, not designed, that frame women in a certain way in this particular culture, policing culture, I'll call it culture. What are the implications of this? So you have women being framed in this particular, what are some of the implications? If I'm a citizen and I'm interested in having a professional police department, what does this mean for me?
Well, to me, I think it's partly explanatory by why fewer women go into law enforcement. It would be hard to be at a job to feel like you have to carry everybody who's similar to you in some way. So, the idea of negative tokenism, I guess, was what I could think of, to where, okay, you're here because we need women. I'm doing that in air quotes. And look, we can find all these failures that are failures anybody might do, but then it becomes for a justification for why women shouldn't be here. And then if you work in a job like that, then it can be hard to want to stay and do it. And then the other idea of the it takes a special woman concept is, well, you adapt to us, that the organization and the culture doesn't really need to adapt to work environments the same way most others have.
So we're going to both not get, so this is, you're saying it's going to discourage females from remaining in or being drawn to the profession. And then also it inhibits the ability of the department to change in ways that citizens, I think right now in particular, maybe want. Is that where you're getting at?
Right. And then it become, even though there might be formal policies and formal efforts to recruit, which have really gone up, to recruit women, that it's harder than that, because then the informal elements step in and make it difficult.
Another thing, I will just take a few more minutes here. I know your time's valuable. One thing I didn't ask you about was, you sort of distinguish between stories. So that we talked about the importance of stories in police culture, but there is a distinction between the war story, which you mentioned that as a category, and then the sort of end of shift stories. For us, it was, we would go to I worked the night shift, so I work overnight, and we would all go to, the calls would slow down at like 4, and then 5, we'd all roll into Denny's, and we'd tell our stories as first shift came on. What's the difference between those stories and the war stories? Can you talk about setting and meaning?
Yeah, so I would say that there's also the sometimes called flow of action stories, which are, this just happened and you getting together, and maybe as the, even if you made an arrest or something, they're still in the holding area and people start talking, oh, we had to do this and that. And some of that actually probably translates into the actual formal narrative. People will start running their story. What did you see? What did I see? And then they start putting it together. And then the end of shift stories, I think, are interesting in a couple of ways, because you have 4, 5, 6 officers get together, you collapse that time and space again to one person might have a more interesting story and they tell it, and then that becomes part of the shared identity of everybody. Again, I think those are closer to a camaraderie building. They're closer to probably the factual account narratives. And then over time, some of those probably do become war stories, right? So if you had a particular event, I also see those as the end of shift ones is also a decompression element too. So I think of those, the area that I was interested in stress, I actually think of those as a real positive area to the most degree, right? That they can be a way of processing difficult situations that happen during a job. And then also they become a learning tool, where officers indicate that they would talk about, well, did you try this or did you try that? The war stories are completely social. They're completely for that element of telling a story. They're usually done in more, people talked about doing them camping or at the bars or Yeah, a lot of drinking involved in war stories. People talked about shift parties as well, that like if you work night shift, you couldn't get off and go have beer somewhere. So people might all congregate at a house and they'll drink beers at 8 o'clock in the morning because you did an overnight and you're scrambling eggs and sitting around. And then they tell stories. These are also the ones that get more exaggerated over time. But in some ways they can shape identity even more because there's the social context of them. And then there's also the greater meaning ascribed to those, I guess.
So yeah, you at the end of the, what you're saying is at the end of the shift, there's a lot of immediate utility creating a shared narrative of the experiences that we had that night as a group, making some sense of them, maybe learning how we can handle it better. It's much tighter to the data, I guess, like tighter to the story. Whereas the war story is more removed and more about these broader, like, meaning of who we are as police officers. And is that?
Yeah, I think so. But then they're also, there's for comical effect too, right? I mean, they're that camaraderie building in a more general sense. So,
but what do you think I've heard this come up a ton when people talk about the gallows humor, dark humor, the police officers, nurses, and you obviously heard this in your story.
You know, I was a social worker and a probation.
Right.
Dark humor existed.
So what would be your explanation for why human beings in particular walks of life rely on it?
Well, I think I bring this up with my students too, or going into social work. I'm like, when you first go in, you're going to hear, you know, grizzled social work telling stories. And at first you might be mortified, like, oh my God, are we respecting the clients? Are we respecting the people who are harmed? But I do think that when you experience, you know, traumatic or very difficult situations, that you have to have a way to decompress that. And so sometimes gallows humor and dark humor become a way of laughing at a difficult situation. And so the thing I tell students is a little bit like, have you ever been so stressed that then something happens and you just start laughing and it becomes this cathartic let loose? Or have you been, every funeral I've ever gone to of somebody close, at some point somebody starts telling stories, mm-hmm. and laugh, and we decompress. So I think there's a human element that's related to that. And so I think we have to be cautious of being overly critical, and I think it can go there, being overly critical of the gallows humor, because I do think it kind of exists across professions, and it probably is a useful tool. And I don't think it necessarily develops the narrative in the same way that some of the other things do. So I don't think somebody telling a gallows humor and consuming gallows humor instantly becomes more aggressive or problematic when they're working with the community. And I think most people know to separate those out. So.
Right. And I definitely saw, like, it was a coping mechanism. And I had a recently working on a project, like a violence reduction project, and talking to a citizen who reported an extremely vicious crime. And the police officers responded, and she saw one of the police officers sort of joking about it. It was a really horrible thing.
Right.
And it really traumatized her, like seeing this behavior by the police officer, like it really hurt her, and is something I think is going to have a lasting impact on her.
Right.
But for the officer, I think, was going through the same thing. They were experiencing this absolutely horrible event, and they're experiencing these things on a regular basis. So you use this as a way to, like, shield yourself from right. the reality of what you're witnessing. I apologize to any James Baldwin fans if it wasn't James Baldwin, but I think it was him, talks about how when you're witnessing these things, or you're seeing the people around you exposed to horrible things, that it's like, but for the grace of God, it could be me. So, right. like, it's a way of being almost like gratitude of this shit happens and this is so horrible, and you laugh because it's so unbelievable. Like, that could happen to me, and that spoke to me.
Right. So you laugh so you don't crack up, as they say, right? So you,
right.
Yeah.
It's just something so unbelievable. And I know I've done it with horrible things where I'm like, to break the tension, to be, I don't know, to just keep yourself from being choked up, you know?
And I think in both medicine and law enforcement and social work, these really people professions, it pretty dominates. The other part is, in most of them, it's not designed to be consumed by others, right?
Right.
So it is a performance that's supposed to be encapsulated. And some people even say, you know, and this is where the closed culture element can become around humor, that you wouldn't even tell those jokes to spouses or very close friends, but right, somebody who there and experience it.
No, they would think you were sick. I know,
right, like, they would.
And every once in a while, I will, even today, I left in 2014, so it's been 6 years, I'll be telling jokes or reacting to the world around me, and I'll say something in front of my wife or a colleague, and I'm like, oh, that's the wrong audience.
Right. So my wife has jokes about me that is like, okay, you're going a little too far. Like, that's,
yeah.
Like, okay, I probably crossed over into the dark humor a little bit. But even I was doing an analysis of these text messages of a police department that were accessed via a freedom of information request. And I found little tidbits of dark humor that were in them. And one was this, hey, they better fire up the crematorium. It's going to be that sort of night, right? Where they're just, you know, they're not, I don't think they're purposely trying to be callous to victims. I just think it's like, okay, we're going to have a tough night. Let's all gear up for it. But it could be done in a humorous way.
Yeah. It's like I said, a coping mechasm. But, so you've sort of laid out this picture of a culture where narratives are constructed and shared, and those narratives create an environment that is, I would argue, pretty hostile to women. I think it's a fair thing to say. I mean, having been partners with multiple female officers for extended periods of time and male officers for extended periods of time, I mean, the reality of doing police work in a male body versus a female body, I mean, they're just two completely different,
right.
Experiences. I mean, I can't imagine how difficult it must be. So, we talked about their implications for society. We're supposed to be a democratic society that shapes our police department, and this is an impediment to that. What would you say is needed to change things, to get things on track and create a different environment?
Yeah, and that's where it becomes sort of a complicated issue, because I do think, you know, more demographically appropriate police department is probably useful, but, you know, if there's difficulty in recruiting, and then informal practices are an impediment to that. And I also think you'd see develop, I have another paper on narratives, but I in police departments, and I try to explain the sometimes use of force through a narrative analysis. And I think part of the stories that are also told create the idea of the environment as particularly hostile, and you're working a war zone. This becomes really problematic when police, like, you know, St. Louis, God, I'm forgetting the town.
Ferguson,
yeah. It's the one I used in the analysis, too. But I had some of the grand jury testimony, and the way they described the community they were patrolling was like it was a war zone. We know they all hate us. If we go there, things are going to be bad. And so, and part of that was many of the officers didn't live in the community they patrolled. And that's sort of a separation effect as well. And so, you know, and I know some departments, to greater or lesser degree of effect, have required that you live in the city limits or county limits or something like that. But I do think separation from where you live to where you patrol, while sometimes I could see being very useful, you don't want to, every time you go to out to eat with your family, see people you've made an arrest to. But it also then creates a realistic, to go with the sort of philosophical separation between officers and community. And I see across the board. And then I was interested then, you know, a lot of the stories too are told that if you don't do this job right, you'll die. And there is real fear of death in law enforcement, and there's real chance of death. But if you actually statistically, this is where we go back to, if you statistically look at it compared to other high risk jobs, it's much lower down that risk. But I do believe it comes a part of the identity of police officers. And then so it does help explain why you might shoot an unarmed person. And there's other prejudices and all that built in. I'm not excusing that. But I do believe it then becomes part of the, you know, what's the police story? You rather be judged.
Yeah, by 12 and carried by six. Yeah.
And carried by six. That is a narrative. That's a short narrative about make a decision. And so it, as a side note to that, some of my narrative research is the one question I was at a panel, and they said, on one hand, your research seems really, really critical of police officers. And on another hand, they thought it was very excusing of some of the things that happened. I said, well, that probably means I'm striking a decent balance. But I do believe that the stories that are told can affect how the officers then interpret the situations. And when you add that into places where a narrative of place becomes circumstance, that it does increase the maybe the use of deadlier force than might would it need it to occur.
So two things. So you're saying there's no quick answer to change. You can't change the culture overnight.
No,
I was hoping you'd have that, because then I would, my dissertation would fly by if you gave me that, how to do that. And what it may be, what I'm getting from this is, if it's narratives that are shaping the culture, it's the introduction of new narratives or changing the existing narrative to slowly change this culture. Is that sort of
right? So organizations have narratives too, as well, right? And some of them, policing's more complex because there's sort of these meta narratives that go across from society and our police shows, all the way through departments that kind of share them. So that very, very similar stories might be told in the middle of Kansas as and in Washington, D.C., or is told wherever. So there's these bigger narratives that could maybe need to change for that. But then also organizational narratives. So some of that is leadership putting out things. But the interesting thing is, if informal culture doesn't want it, they just learn how to say the right words around the right people and then continue the cultural elements. So,
yeah, it's a big task. And you talk about this separation. I mean, I know I lived in the suburbs and I policed in the city, and there was a drive. I called it the drive, where on the drive into work, I went through a process where I changed my mental mindset, my vocabulary, the way I interacted with people. I became a different person. And then when I went home, I had to do the same thing. And it was because my perception was that I would be walked all over on at work if I didn't go ready to go to war. And then if I went home ready to go to war, I would end up divorced.
Right.
So the role of citizen and the role of state agent I didn't feel as though they could be brought together. And what you're starting to saying is maybe like having people who are living their regular life in the community, are connected to the community, like breaking down that barrier is another part of this as well.
Or, and you know, you bring up one thing that can happen for police departments too, is they're a little distrustful of outside agents, right? Someone like yourself who has the perspective of now being out of law enforcement, and you probably, even hindsight, you go back and look at things a little differently than time. That I do think there's some credibility to people who have experiences that go and do that. I know when I interviewed officers, I made sure they know I used to be a military police officer. I was a probation officer. This instantly, like, oh, okay, you know a little bit about this.
Absolutely.
And so I think there are some elements of that can help change. And then I don't know. I mean, our culture is so interesting too, because I'm really interested. I haven't got to research on this yet, but how the popular culture media that we consume shapes an officer before they arrive, and even our public perception. So if you think of, we love in movies, the cop who's on the edge, who's, you know, busting somebody's arm in a drawer to get the confession. Reality, we don't want any of our cops like that, because what if they're wrong, you know?
Right.
Somebody might confess if their arm's being broken, whether they committed the crime or not. And so, you know, how does that shape who decides to go into policing at times? What they expect from it? Do they seek out certain parts of the job at the detriment of other parts that they need to develop?
So. And I think that I think you're definitely on it. I mean, when you're drawn to policing, that the narratives in our popular culture about policing, what it is going to, you know, just be a filter in deciding who's drawn to it. And then while you're in a policing role, I know I would go home and watch The Wire at the end of my shift, and I'm watching McNulty. I'm sure that some of the ways that I carried myself and behaved was probably influenced by that character who I identified just like another human being. When you identify with a human being, you adopt, you know, it changes who you are. So I think that's definitely fascinating.
And more than other jobs, there are lots of images of police in movies, et cetera. So, you know, there are some of social workers. I give that as an example to my students, but there's a lot less, right?
Right.
Tons of stuff you can consume on being a police officer.
Well, I know I've had you for over an hour already, so I don't want to take any more of your time. Is there any, so thank you. I'm going to put the article that I read will be in the description below, and as well as a link to your bio. Do you have any final thoughts before we let you go?
No, I think it's an interesting area, and it can apply to other professions within criminal justice. I would like, I'd be interested to see judges, you know. Because they're consuming narratives in multiple ways too, right? They read the official narrative report, but then they also hear somebody describe themselves, how others are shaped, and then also just even how, you know, and there's more of this research out there, but how people who have been arrested then can be defined. And then I'm interested in narrative of place a little bit as well. So these are like 20 years of research if I get through it all, but how do certain places get defined, or even sections of places get defined in a way? So, you know, Chicago over and over is defined as the murder capital. If you look at it per capita, it's like something.
Not anywhere near St. Louis, I can tell you that.
Right. No, St. Louis is actually, I think St. Louis, Baltimore, and I'm from Kansas City. Kansas City, Missouri, in terms of shootings and per capita murders, is really high. But they don't get the same sort of play. And so some of that's a narrative that develops. So a narrative of place. And then also, this is real quick, and maybe I'm a little off a side note, but somebody did research on police officers, and they were wearing the heart monitor, the whole biofeedback. Uh-huh. And they could actually measure their heart rate, how it changed in different parts of the city.
Right.
It's really fascinating to think about. That's narrative of place, right? And some of it could be factually true, that there's higher amounts of crime and murder, but also then that becomes, you know, imprinted in them. So I kind of have some interest in narrative of place as well.
Absolutely, and that's absolutely fascinating. And in cities, to talk about a policing context is like having worked in different parts of a major metropolitan city, the stories that surround that precinct, they're so different. And then the actual the way people police those areas, what they think they can, how they think they should behave and interact with people, I think are shaped by those stories. Right. So I think there's a ton of implications. It's a fascinating line of research.
Right. And to be honest too, one of the big overarching things is that is often these areas that are defined negatively are about poverty more than anything else. It starts with poverty.
Absolutely. So. Yeah, the root of all crime is definitely, I would agree, is there. It's a social problem. So,
yeah.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And
no problem.
Have a great day. Thank you.
You too.